Hey, this is Shai Davidi from Sportsnet. You're listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott and Adam.
Baseball, Blue Jays, and more baseball. It's the Walk Off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
This ball is crushed.
The Die Hard Podcast for the casual fan. Wire.
And another one. My goodness.
So pleased to be joined by today's guest, Toronto Blue Jays insider and Sportsnet analyst, Shai Davidi. Welcome to the walk-off, my man. Thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. My pleasure.
Yeah, I did want to start with, too, that I really enjoy your work and have for years. I love your written stuff. Just the way you present the game on broadcast, too. Thoroughly enjoy it. So well done, and thank you for that.
That goes for both of us.
Yes.
I appreciate the kind words. You know, we're always trying to find ways to connect with as wide an audience as possible. So it's nice to hear that. Thank you.
Absolutely. So in a scenario like yesterday where the Jays have a day off, does that kind of double as a little bit of a reprieve on your end too? Or are you sort of no days off till November here?
I took a little bit of a breather yesterday just because I had some other things going on with my teaching at Centennial that I'd been running through for a bit. But, you know, typically I'd be writing on a day off and chasing some stuff. I did still put in a few calls to people, have some conversations just to keep abreast of what's going on. But it was, a little bit lighter of a day than it normally would have, which was every once in a while you need it, you know, just...
Yeah.
It's a long season, and really, I mean, for a lot of us, like, even though there was the pandemic, you know, like I haven't had a proper time off since after the 2019 season. So it's been a bit of a grind.
Well, as fans and an audience, it's funny how you never think of the grind of the broadcast side of things in a 162 game season, but it exists.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, look, it was definitely lighter last year. And let's not, you know, overstate things. You know, I still could have a real job. And this is obviously far, far preferable. But, you know, last year without travel, it was the first time in a decade that I didn't either have a dream about missing a flight or wake up in a hotel room not sure where I am, and so that made it a little bit easier. But I think for like a lot of people who are doing the work from home thing, there's this whole, you know, sort of work day never ends, no delineation between home and work, and so it's been an interesting year without a doubt.
It is interesting. It's funny. I truly relate to that as a touring comic. All of a sudden, yeah, I'm not worried about what time I'm leaving. There's nothing to get up for. There aren't flights. It's just, yeah. all right, my man. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's going to be weird trying to imagine going back to that life, right?
Yeah.
I mean, which we all want to.
Yeah.
But then it's amazing how adaptable we are, right? And how quickly, you know, we adjust to sort of new normals. And it's weird to think about having to adjust back to that. Exciting to think of it too, though.
Well,
too.
I'm almost embarrassed to say it. Like 14 months ago, I had never done a video chat in my entire life. And now... Yeah. Like hundreds probably.
Yeah, 100%. And it's not the best way to work, obviously, but it's amazing how much, you know, with a little bit of ingenuity and a little bit of determination, how quickly we can adapt.
Agreed. All right, so let's delve into the Blue Jays here. I know we'll start with Hinjin Ryu, because after Sunday afternoon in Tampa, the entire Blue Jays fan base had a bit of a freak out, myself included. It looks like we may have dodged a bullet. Do you have any updates on where Hinjin Ryu is and what happened on Sunday?
Well, we're expecting a little bit more information later today, so I wish I had something more current to give you. But it's funny, you're talking about your reaction. You know, even Charlie Montoyo had that reaction in general. You know, we asked him about it. He said, I can't repeat what I was thinking, which is pretty much sums up, I think, the collective feeling for Blue Jays fans everywhere. But, you know, we typically don't hear the Blue Jays talking that way after an injury, if there's a possibility that it's going to be serious. You know, Hyunjin Ryu said he doesn't think it should be an injury-less situation. You know, Charlie Montoyo was playing it down too. And that's atypical. So, you know, to me, the fact that they were willing to talk in that way and describe the situation in that fashion leads me to think that it wasn't serious, but you know, we'll see. He, you know, Ryu was saying that he's planning to go through his normal process for his next start, and we'll get a little bit more information in terms of how that went for him later this afternoon.
I know I heard that too, and I was very curious on your thoughts about how he handled that on the mound, because he right away called Jansen out and he called for the trainer to come out. And I feel like a younger pitcher, maybe who didn't know his body as well, or maybe was pushing a little bit more for a spot, would have tried to pitch through it, whereas he was just like, no, let's shut this down.
Right. But, you know, this is someone who's very in tune with his body and has had to be because of his injury history. And obviously some of the stuff was more severe with his arm. But, you know, if you're an athlete and you're realizing, you know, I think most athletes realize between I can get through this versus I need to stop. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he didn't say this. But, you know, there was some video that Daniel Kim, a reporter out of South Korea, he shot before the game in his bullpen. And, you know, Ryu was starting on a pitch and it looked like he was fighting something in his leg at that point. Mm-hmm. So he may have felt it and then may have had a repeat. And then at that point he thought to himself, okay, we better stop.
Yeah.
And that, look, you know, he understands that, you know, two more innings on that Sunday is far less important than staying off the injured list. Mm-hmm. And that's an important bit of recognition. He understands his importance to the team. He understands how he's really the linchpin of that pitching staff and that how important his start every 5 or 6 days is to this team. So yeah, really smart on his end. And he said afterwards, you know, that he felt good about his decision, even though he felt bad about dumping all that work on the bullpen. He felt good about the decision and ensuring that something small stayed something small.
Which, as a fan, we're all thankful for. So yeah. I know we were getting messages from our listeners right up until we started talking with you. And so many of them were George Springer. Do we get to see him today? Do you know, or are you waiting on that too?
I don't know for sure. My expectation is that we do see him this evening. I wish I had it for you. I've gotten a lot of emails and texts on that just yet. Typically, the Blue Jays like to wait to the very last minute to make a decision, use all the information at hand, you know, ensure that over the course of the day, nothing suddenly sneaks up on George. But you know, all the indications are that he's going to be ready. And, you know, the way that the Blue Jays pushed him in the last few days, you know, if they wouldn't have been that aggressive with him if he wasn't on track and wasn't mm-hmm. building up towards this.
Well, let's be honest. The Blue Jays don't like to tip their hand when it comes to their day-to-day lineups too long before the game anyways, right?
No, I mean, they don't like to tip their hand with anything. So, yeah. you know, it's like their wish would be that they could just tell us everything on their terms strictly. But, you know, which is understandable. Like this is especially with the way information moves today. But
is that more of this regime type of thing, or was it like that in the Anthopoulos days as well?
I mean, every regime has its own quirks, right? And you know, I think with this one, look, there's a lot at stake with George Springer, right? Like, you know, this is the biggest investment in franchise history. You know, Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins, to a certain degree, are going to be tied to this contract. You know, their legacy hinges a little bit on that contract. And he's really going to be, I don't want to say the straw that stirs the drink, but, you know, he's going to be a guy who's going to really define whether this season is a success or not. Right. I mean, if he performs and he's within the, you know, the 4-5 war projections that, you know, the models have for him this year, if he delivers that kind of performance, then this team's got a chance to be a legitimate contender. And if it doesn't, they're, you know, a 500 club and, you know, they're fighting it a little bit. So, you know, I can understand the caution. And the other thing is that the Blue Jays don't want to create something worse now that ends up lingering and impacting performance down the road, right? We're talking about a 6-year contract here, six-year commitment. So, you know, as much as there's so much pressure and excitement, and, you know, I've seen the comments and heard the comments from fans, or it was like, you know, is this really happen? You know, is or is this like Snuffleupagus on Sesame Street. You know, it's like this thing that everybody hears about it, but it's not true. You know, like I think we get that, and that's understandable. But you know, if you're viewing this within, you know, 3 to 4 weeks over 6 years, all of a sudden your perspective on it changes. And I think the Blue Jays have to view it that way, and most fans probably can't.
Well, it is exciting. I mean, again, just the fact that he was the biggest signing in franchise history, like, of course, as a fan, you want to see him, but it makes all the sense in the world, especially with him having past oblique problems and stuff like that. You don't want to, like you said, give up a year of 6 years when you could have just given up 5 weeks or something like that. So last injury thing here. Everyone is curious. We know Nate Pearson is pitching. We know he had that intra-squad game on the weekend. Any word on how he looked, and is there a timeline at all yet? Is it looking like next week?
No. Well, there weren't too many reports, actually, and out of that game. But, I mean, he threw 51 pitches, and that's the important thing. And, you know, I likened it to roughly be, if you were in a normal spring training, he's sort of like the early to mid part of March right now. So, you know, 51, they're probably go up to 65, 70 pitches in his next start, you know, get him up to 85 afterwards and try to push him, you know, 95, 100 beyond that. And then probably do that once or twice. So I think that it's probably at least a couple more weeks before he's on the horizon. This is another one that the Blue Jays have to be really cautious with, right? Because, you know, he did the groin once, re-aggravated it. But there's pressure on this one, right? Like for the rotation, and there are holes that are coming up at the end of this week where they're going to need some extra starters. And, you know, they've been able to sort of run this modified three-man rotation over the past week and a half and into the end of this week,
which is wild.
Because they've had, I know. Well, I mean, you get 4 off days in 2 weeks. It's just a really bizarre bit of scheduling.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's sort of been timely for them the way things have worked out. But that's ending. And so, you know, they're going to need fourth and fifth starters in a week and a half. And so they've got some stuff to figure out. And, you know, ideally Nate Pearson's one of those guys, but I think that's going to be a little bit quick. He's going to be a little bit beyond that. But the fact that he's on the horizon is big for this team because, you know, you look at the way, you know, Robbie Ray's been throwing the ball. Steven Matz certainly has been terrific. You know, as long as Ryu's healthy, you add Nate Pearson to that mix, you know, all of a sudden this is a pretty competitive rotation and one that can carry you for a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, while we're talking pitching, the truth is with this Jays pitching, it's been unbelievable. Like through 21 games, they're at a 3.02 ERA. I know you know all this stuff. It's the best they've been through 21 games pitching wise ever in franchise history. They're the best in baseball right now. They've given up the fewest runs in the American League. So two questions here for you. Number one, do you think that the fan base and maybe even the media around the league underestimated this front office's ability to kind of understand and evaluate the upside of this pitching staff and the depth in the system? And is this sustainable in any way?
All right. So, you know, basically the pitching has turned out like we all predicted, right? So did we underestimate it? Like, I don't know if the media underestimated it. Like, I think everybody's kind of sad that, you know, they've got this potential, like there are a lot of good arms, but what does that look like? Right. And we have to be careful that we don't overweigh a 21 game sample or whatever it is, 3 week sample, because, you know, this can still go a couple different ways, right? And that, you know, there's some guys that the league hasn't seen, you know, like an Anthony Castro, who's been terrific and an incredibly great surprise, but, you know, he's going to adjust. You know, American League teams have seen Matz a little bit, but, you know, they're going to get a better look at him. And, you know, what does that look like his second and third times through facing teams? You know, so there certainly is the possibility for some regression. But they've performed beyond expectations. And if they can be somewhere along those lines, then yeah, they've got a little bit more depth. Now, where I think that the concern would be is that they've had to use the bullpen quite a bit to this point. And, you know, that catches up with teams, right? Like, you could do that over 60 games the way they did last year. but you can't sustain that over 162 games. And you even look at the Tampa Bay Rays, who I think would be a great example of that last year, where, you know, that bullpen was running out of gas towards the end. You know, like Nick Anderson was great throughout the season, and then he just hit a wall because they'd used him so much. And
that was 60 games.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, I think the Blue Jays recognize the fact that they're going to need more out of the rotation on a consistent basis. They can't have, you know, they had two bullpen games in a week, essentially, and they're going to have another one tonight and then potentially another one on the weekend. Like, you know, they can't do that consistently, even with a nine-man bullpen. So, you know, the performance, I think, is certainly legitimate, and you know, they're just flat out been great, but they have to be wary about putting too much on these guys, and, you know, making sure that, you know, they can still perform in this way come August and September.
How much of this pitching success should the credit be given to Pete Walker?
Well, I think certainly, you know, a lot of credit it goes to him. You know, the fact that, you know, guys like Steven Matz and Robbie Ray can come here and, you know, rejuvenate themselves with him, you know, is it really a credit to the environment he sets? And, you know, as much as people kind of like say, like, oh, he's going to come in and he fixes guys right away, I think what he does more effectively than, as opposed to just, you know, hammering guys with do this, do this, do this, is just gives them the space and the guidance to find themselves and find what they need to succeed. And, you know, there's a really subtle distinction there, but it's a really important one, because, you know, a lot of coaches will just sort of hammer at guys, say, like, you need to do this, you need to do this, you're not doing this, you're not doing this. Whereas, you know, Pete has a way where he's like, well, you know, if you want to get to, he listens to what players are trying to do. He says, well, if you want to get to this, what if you tried this? Or this is what I see. How do you think you can kind of get to here? And that's a really, really important way of dealing with a person without sort of building their trust and gaining a little bit of credibility with them, where it's not like, hey, I'm going to tell you what to do. It's more, hey, I'm going to give you some ideas. Let me know what works, and I'll throw in my two cents along the way.
Almost half pitching coach, half psychologist. Like,
well, you know, that's a lot of coaching, right? A lot of that is sort of the capital you're able to build up with your players. Just like, you know, any good manager in any industry, right? It's like the ones who just tell people what to do, you know, that can wear thin and doesn't always connect with people. Whereas the ones who really learn to understand you and can figure you out and can kind of help you, you just build a rapport with you where you want to take what they're giving you, you know, that's a huge part of the battle. So, you know, I think that's where some of Pete's strength is. You know, Matt Bushman, the bullpen coach, is really good at that as well. And the Blue Jays have some good analytics that they can give to their pitchers. And certainly, you know, the material that they've been, you know, the package, I guess, has worked relatively well for quite a few guys.
So if Pete has done such a good job, and he definitely deserves a lot of credit, and so do the pitchers who have put in the time to kind of turn themselves around, guys like Steven Matz, I know Danny Jansen and catching in general is really under fire from the fan base, and probably even justly so. But if we're going to talk about how good this pitching is, how much credit do you think Danny Jansen deserves in this?
You know, Danny Jansen is really underrated and underappreciated. And he's going through a terrible time at the plate right now. There's no doubt about it. And he is 100% a much better hitter than this. And, you know, getting that to come up, you know, I think Sunday could be a good little springboard for him, even though he ends up hitless.
Yeah.
You know, he hits that laser beam to third base that rips Brasso's glove off. And, you know, if he's had any sort of luck, you know, that ball doesn't go right to shortstop. It goes into the outfield and, you know, slump over. You know, there's another laser to the outfield after that too. You know, he's just fighting it a little bit right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, his track record is that he's been a good hitter. And it's not just minor league numbers. It was approach. It was all the underlying principles that suggest that he should be a good hitter in the major leagues, or at least a competitive hitter in the major leagues. They were all there. Why they haven't shown up, great question. But I don't think that you need to run away from him, particularly because, well, one, they don't have a ton of options. But two, he's also a tremendous defender, right? He's a great game caller. He's really taken a step forward in terms of, you know, reading games, you know, not necessarily sticking to game plans, adjusting based on what he's seeing. Pitchers trust him. And that there's tremendous value in that. You know, it's like, you know, you can't just parachute a guy in and say, all right, here, handle the club and it's all good and go. Right. There are a lot of different pitchers. The demands on a catcher are so much further along now than what they used to be. Catchers have to process a lot more information, especially before a game. You know, it was funny, I was asking John Schneider about this the other day, but, you know, typically back in the day, you know, catcher, they'd have a scouting report, they have a few ideas, they start a game, see how things are going and make decisions based on that. You know, now they've got all this information and it's like, you know, if you get this guy into a 2-2 count, you know, a fastball in this quadrant of the zone at this velocity is in all likelihood going to generate this result, right? So there's all these different pieces of information that a catcher has to put together and apply and keep in mind. And they've got the info on the wristband and, you know, there's so many factors. Jansen's great at that. You know, Kirk's learning curve has been very good, but there's still a long way to go. So, you know, for better or for worse, you know, Jansen's still got a pretty good bit of runway here, I would think. And you know, in to a certain degree, he's really earned it.
That was actually going to be my next question, and it's interesting to hear that, and I'm all for it. Do you think there's any chance, could there be a legitimate consideration of them adding a veteran catcher like a Jonathan Lucroy or a Matt Wieters, or does it really look like Jansen solidified till at least the trade deadline?
Well, you know, I do think that the Blue Jays will look at it, right? But all along, in terms of what I've heard with all these different catching options, is that with the group that they had, and they were going to sort of run with them and see where it takes them. Now, you know, does this cause you to, you know, I mean, if you add Jonathan Lucroy right now, are you optioning Alejandro Kirk? Are you optioning Denny Jansen? You know, and what is that doing for your team? And, you know, is Lucroy going to come in and be able to handle a staff right off the ground? And I don't know. I think that it's certainly something that's worth looking at. You know, it's worth remembering that these guys are out on the market for a reason, mm-hmm. and that they're not locks to give you a lot more. You know, but Jansen's got to pick it up a little bit offensively, and, you know, he can't be a total zero there. But, you know, I also don't expect the catching OPS to be 300 or whatever it is right now, you know, for the rest of the season. You know, that's going to correct at some point too.
There's almost no way that it can get worse. Like, there's literally almost no way this catching position can put up worse offensive numbers. So maybe it is worth waiting it out. Like,
yeah. You know, it's funny because I wonder, like, there's a part of fandom, right, where you're always impatient, and which makes sense. But I'm wondering if some of the impact of last year's 60 game season plays into that from a psychological aspect
totally.
Too, because there was so much pressure, right? Like 60 games, like last year, you're 33% of the way through right now.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas, you know, right now you're nothing, you know, this is a blip. It's a total blip.
Yeah.
So, you know, to try and read into anything that happens this month and extrapolate that over, you know, 5.5 more months is foolhardy. So, you know, I think that's where, you know, if this happens to Danny Jansen in the middle of the season, you know, after he's had a base of games, and are we talking about it in the same way? You know, probably not. So, you know, I definitely think it's early to premature to run away from them. But this is certainly something that you're flagging and saying, like, you know, if it's going to be a 500 OPS from the catcher spot this year, well, you know, is that going to cut it? And probably not.
it's funny how much more difficult it is to deal with as a fan and as a player, I'm sure, slumps off the start of the season. You know, like, you could just see even Rowdy Tellez, like, he's killing it now, but oh boy, when he was 0-for-21, you could just tell he was gripping it tighter and like in his own head. Like, even when he hit that single to break that streak, and he's just like, I did it. Like,
and the way the guys were teasing him about it too, which was great. It's funny, because I actually asked Rowdy that specific question. I said, you know, how much different is coping with this slump in the first, or, you know, right out of the gate, as opposed to, you know, the middle of July? And he said, you know, as much as you tell yourself it shouldn't matter and not to look at numbers, you know, it's when there's a triple zero staring you in the face, it's right there, right? It's like, you know, it's like anytime he'd look up at the scoreboard, whether he wanted to check a pitch velocity or wanted to check the count or whatever the case is, there it is, reminding you, you know, like, you're still hitless. So, you know, there's definitely a psychological element to that. But, you know, he got some good advice from Jimmy Van Ostrand, a Blue Jays mental performance coach, a former Canadian national team player, Canadian Olympian. And he had said to him, you know, your average shouldn't matter to you until you're 200 at bats in. You know, that's the point where, you know, you're starting to get a reasonable sample and a meaningful sample off which to evaluate yourself. And, you know, that's something that he had to keep telling himself, and that a lot of guys who get off to slow starts need to keep telling themselves, right?
Absolutely.
It's a long, long marathon. And, you know, as fans, we can forget that. You know, players forget it too, right? I mean, even though they know how long of a grind it is, but everybody's impatient, right? And everybody has recency bias and all these things that you have to fight against. And, you know, sometimes that mental part of the game is really a losing battle.
Speaking of patience, it has been impressive how patient this front office has been, and now to watch it kind of all the groundwork start to lay out. So I'd love to get your take on Mark Shapiro's comments in the offseason about the possibility of the Blue Jays being a behemoth. And I recently read an article in The Athletic from Jason Stark that was really kind of deep diving into what it would take for the Jays to be a behemoth. Right. And it would take them being a perennial contender, that it would mean operating in a similar realm to the Yankees, Dodgers, Red Sox, spending even more than they are right now, probably substantially more. How do you feel about this? Like, when you look at the groundwork that this front office has laid and the moves they've made this offseason and where they're headed, in your opinion, are the Blue Jays on the way to being an actual behemoth?
That's an interesting question, because I think the definition of behemoth can be a little bit subjective, right? What I would say is that, so I think if you look at the franchise history, like, you look at the buildup from inception to the World Series years that Pat Gillick put together, and that is the model. To me, that is a true behemoth from, like, say, 1983 through 1993, and maybe beyond into 94, you know, this team was just the class of Major League Baseball, you know, player development, you know, towards the end, external acquisitions, you know, economically, from a fan standpoint, you know, this was really the total package. So the Blue Jays have been a behemoth before. And then for a number of reasons, which would probably take an entire podcast to describe, you know, that fell off. And then, you know, they went through a long period in the wilderness. But I think the Blue Jays are positioned right now to have that type of run. They have the potential to have that, because they're young right now at the major league level. They have a host of young players coming in the minor league system. And they still, relative to the talent level, don't have a ton of money tied up in the books. Like, they have financial flexibility. They still have another mega contract in them, I would expect, next offseason. So they have a chance. You know, if we were in a normal world and there hadn't been this pandemic interruption, I mean, you would think that they would be playing, they would have the potential to draw into the high twos, maybe low threes, millions in attendance.
Yeah.
You know, they'd be, you know, crushing it in TV ratings and all those things and corporate dollars. So, you know, that would be a good springboard. They could continue to build off that and then into the coming years as well. So, you know, does that fit a behemoth? I mean, potentially. Where I think the gap is going to be is that, you know, and this is based on conversations that I've had with different people, is that I don't think the Blue Jays see themselves as a club that's going to be top five in payroll in the major leagues,
right.
especially while they have the Rogers Center as their home. You know, maybe that changes a little bit if they end up successfully building that new stadium, that sports entertainment complex that, you know, they have in the plans or the ownership of Rogers is trying to put together. But, you know, as things stand, I think they're probably more of a, you know, 5 to 10 payroll team, you know, or maybe very, very high teens. And, you know, does that fit the description of a behemoth? I don't know. It depends. You have to be really good from a performance perspective at that point. Mm-hmm. And you have to continue to ensure that your scouting is identifying players and that your player development system is churning them out because you won't be able to buy whoever you want. So, you know, I don't think that they have the capacity to be a Dodgers, Yankees, Red Sox at their peaks. But, you know, they can slot in right behind them. And I think that could be good enough.
Could they be a Padres?
I mean, they should be more than the Padres.
Right? Okay, good. As long as we're on the same page.
Yeah, I mean, the Padres did an amazing job. The Padres put together such an amazing base of talent. And I know some people in the game have sort of sneered at, you know, the way that they've used prospects to sort of build up players. And they're like, well, you're just bringing in all these disparate parts. Is that really what you are? Or, you know, are you going too fast? Are you trying to short circuit the process or, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're the Blue Jays, you're like, yeah, I mean, we could do the Hosmer contract and the Tatis contract. And, you know, the market capacity says you should be able to do a lot more than that. Like, you know, maybe you're pushing towards where the Red Sox are at financially on a consistent basis. You know, yeah. I mean, the market capacity is there. You know, this is the, I don't know, probably the third or fourth best market in North America. You know, especially when you factor in that the Blue Jays are a coast to coast market, essentially. There's no reason for them to, you know, I don't like to see them cap themselves as a high teens team,
yeah,
because they from a payroll perspective, because they have the ability to be beyond that. They just have to be good. And, you know, I think if they're good and the world is normal and we can open up, then, you know, I think that all the revenue capacity here is huge. We saw it on a short-term basis in 15-16.
Yeah, absolutely.
But is that sustainable for a decade and a half? You know, that's a great question. And, you know, I think it would be, but, you know, somebody's got to give the market an opportunity to prove that first.
Okay. So we have a pile of listener questions, which we will get to here very shortly. I kind of took this one, because this was asked lots. So, where are you at on this with the, and I know you've probably been asked this a pile, left side of the infield has had some problems. Will we
I hadn't
see more?
Noticed.
Yeah, right. No one has, so it's perfect. This has gone under the radar. Will we see more games like Sunday with guys like Simeon and Espinal at third and short? Like, is Charlie going to try and shore up that left side, or is he going to just let Biggio and Bichette find it?
All right, so I'm gonna give you my thoughts on it first, as opposed to answering the question directly first, and I. What I'm going to start with Biggio, because playing third base at the major league level is such a complete and total different animal from doing it in the minor league level. So he had a handful of games there in the minors. He's had a handful of games there in the major league level. And to expect him to just shift over and there to be no adjustment period is incredibly tough, mm-hmm. right? I mean, this is a, you know, the ball comes at you faster. There's a lot more spin. The reaction time is really shortened. You know, for to give, if you're going to be fair to Biggio, he's got to get at least half a season there before you can really evaluate it. And, you know, as much as people are harping on, you know, the play that wasn't made Saturday night, that ball through the wickets, the Manuel Margot ball, you know, you think about the play in the opening day of the season where, you know, he fields a chopper at third and throws out a runner at home. It's a game saving play. Mm-hmm. And that's a really, really strong play for someone just learning the position. So, you know, I don't think you can look at the downside without looking at some of the upside too. And for him to get a reasonable shot at it, like, you know, you gotta just like say half a season, let's see what happens. Similarly with Bo Bichette, you know, he's still at, you know, fewer than 100 games, I believe, in his big league career. You know, he doesn't even have 1,000 innings at shortstop in the majors. He's really young there. And the athleticism suggests to you that he can play the position. The raw ability suggests he's got enough arm. He's got enough range. He can do the things that he needs to do. But you worry because you don't see him making routine plays on a consistent basis. And that's troubling. But then he can go out and make a spectacular play to end the game against the Yankees in Dunedin when he, mm-hmm. you know, slid up the middle, spun around and threw basically while he was in midair. You know, a handful of guys can make that play, right? So again, the pieces are there, but is he long-term your guy? I'm not sure yet. Now the question becomes, can the Blue Jays provide them both enough runway? Can they live through those growing pains? And when they're hitting the way that they should be hitting, then they're going to be able to mask that stuff, right? When, you know, if the Blue Jays aren't, you know, fighting tooth and nail to get runs out, you know, they win that game Saturday and it's not an issue, right? You know, when you're scrounging for runs, everything gets magnified. So I think if the Blue Jays are going to be fair to those guys, they have to give them more runway. They have to show confidence in them, but they do have to work on them, on things with them. And they are, right?
This is one of those things that it's a patience thing again, that us fans are so great at. Yeah.
Well, but it's not only patience from fans, it's patience from the Blue Jays themselves, mm-hmm. right? You know, it's hard because you got Marcus Semien sitting right there, and that's a MVP caliber shortstop. Right. And you know that he can make those plays for you. And, you know, I thought my colleague Jeff Blair had a pretty interesting idea when, you know, what if you move Semien to third base and you put Biggio back to second where he's a bit more comfortable, and then having a little bit more stability to his right maybe helps Bo Bichette a little bit up the middle.
Which is, I mean, true. How much time has Semien played at third base?
He's got a handful of games there at the big leagues too. He'd be more familiar with that than he would be with second base, right? When he transitioned. So, you know, it's doable for him. But I think it becomes a matter of, like, you know, he's just getting comfortable at second. Like, are you going to displace him? Like, how much do you want to do this to your roster? And at a certain point, like, I think the other thing that, you know, everybody needs to recognize is that you essentially have four guys in the infield learning a position. Right. You know, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is learning first base still. You know, Semien is learning second. Biggio is learning third. And Bo is still building up at short, which is the second most demanding position on the diamond behind catcher. So, you know, that being the case, this was always the potential for there to be some trouble spots here. And I think the Blue Jays have to be a little bit patient. Now, you know, I think every once in a while we're going to see days like we saw Sunday, where, you know, both guys are getting a bit of a break. That makes sense. But, you know, I think if you run away from this too quickly, you do some damage to the players as well. And I don't think you can do that at this point.
Well, the truth is reps don't just happen. You have to put in the time to do it. And like you just kind of stated, like, a lot of these guys are at new positions. And if the Jays fans can take anything away from last season, it's look at how much Vladimir Guerrero Jr. has improved at first base. He looks like a totally different guy at first base. He is a totally different guy at first base. And that's just reps. That's just being there and doing it.
it's also game speed reps, right? Yes. And we need to kind of make a distinction. I mean, you can take 1,000 ground balls. I mean, it's totally different from doing it in the moment in a game as things are happening, right? And I think that's where the distinction is right now. But, you know, you mentioned Guerrero. That's a great example. But, you know, think about Teoscar Hernandez, right? Yeah. Like, there was a point in time where, like, can this guy play the outfield? And now he's fine.
Yeah.
Right? You're fine with him out there. You know, he may not be amazing, but he's fine.
Yeah.
And, you know, if Bo Bichette can just be fine at shortstop with his bat, that's going to work. And Kevin Biggio just needs to be fine at third base. And maybe that's that's something that they can address prior to the trade deadline too, temporarily because of Biggio's flexibility and ability to move around the diamond. So, you know, we're going to hyper focus on it. It's happening right now. It's glaring, but you know, I think the Blue Jays would be wise to just take a step back, not do this with emotion, and just kind of. Just have a little bit of patience with both those guys. I think they both have earned it and both deserve it.
You know, it's funny you mentioned how offense masks those defensive struggles that they're having. And if Bo Bichette's hitting like we know he can't, I mean, he's not struggling that bad by any means. But you look at a guy like Fernando Tatis. He missed almost 10 days of the season already. Still leads the league in errors. Nobody's talking about the errors he's making at shortstop, right?
Yeah. So, right.
That's a great point that that offense just needs to uptick
when you're depending on 1-0 wins to take series against Tampa Bay. It's a ride.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, you have to be able to win those games too if you're going to be a good team.
Absolutely.
If you're going to be an October team, you have to be able to win 1-0. You have to be able to win 10-8 too. But you know, I think to extrapolate that what we've seen over the first 3 weeks is going to continue in perpetuity is unfair. It's definitely something that you have to pay attention to and start being a little bit concerned about. But you know, to kind of make a panic position switch and to do things like that, I think that would be really premature because you're cutting off the potential for, you know, what could be an impact shortstop. But two, it's like, you know, you're just going to ask him to start playing second base in the middle of the season and do all those things. Like, you know, that's not easy either.
Yeah.
Right. And like, but you're also putting him at some physical risk because he has to turn the double play from a different angle. He has to get all the plays are happening at the opposite side and he's not used to those movements. And there are a whole host of things that you have to be aware of. You know, you don't want to put him at physical risk either. You have to be fair to him.
100%. So one of the things that we here on the Walk-Off have been incredibly lucky to do with this podcast is we've talked to a dozen or more prospects in the Blue Jays system. And one of the things that has really kind of stood out to me is the mental approach and the work ethic seems universal throughout the system. I mean, honestly, we talked to CJ Van Eyck and Adam Klofenstein. Both of them made time for us Friday nights after spring training games. And you always hear about the culture in Cleveland or the Cardinal way in St. Louis. Do you get a sense that this Blue Jays organization is kind of developing their own sort of system and system-wide culture?
Well, I'm going to answer that in a couple different ways. I mean, I think that's important. And I do think that they're very much developing sort of a Blue Jay characteristic, right? And this is, you know, I think the Blue Jays were on track towards that under the Alex Anthopoulos regime. And then it changed and it's evolved a little bit and transformed a little bit. But there's something that they're trying to establish. Like, this is the way we do things across the organization up the chain. But to me, that what you were talking about is player specific, right? Like,
right.
You have to get, like, you can be in the best culture in the world, and if you are an indifferent person or you're not highly competitive or you're not highly driven, then it doesn't matter because it's not innate. And maybe that, you know, rising tide floats all boats, but, you know, if you're really going to get there, it has to be innate. it has to come from inside of you. So, you know, I think that's more a credit to the individual. But, you know, I think where you really end up having a ton of success is when you get that driven individual, put them into a good culture, and that's when you can really create something special.
Right. So it's almost like the culture rises guys who would work hard and do that anyways.
Right. You know, I think culture is super important, but I think the quality of individual, like, you know, you can have sort of, if you don't have a good culture, if you don't have tremendous people there.
So it's a chicken and the egg sort of idea.
You know, I think so personally, you know, like you can have, if you have like a good culture, but like, you know, like it's one or two good people and then just a bunch of mediocre around you, you know, maybe you're driving it up a little bit, but you're still hitting a ceiling.
Yeah.
You have to have, and I think this is in any business and any sort of work environment, not just on a professional sports team, but you know, it's the more high quality driven people you have, the better your culture is going to be. Because if you just have a bunch of average around and just people who aren't working hard and people who aren't dedicated and things like that, you know, that's going to show up because that's the work ethic that you're bringing into your culture.
All right. We should get to some listener questions here before we let you go or we'll get in trouble. really do appreciate your time and these very thorough and in-depth answers. So how we took our listener questions is we have a Discord where our listeners come in and kind of do their thing. So some of these are names and some of these are just their handles, right? So this first one is from Verosity. And he says, now that we have some sample size, roughly 20 games into the season, Shai, what is your take on the AL East division? Will the Yankees still be the beast everyone thought before their slow start? Are the Red Sox for real? How did the Rays do it again with pitching? Have you changed your opinions at all on the AL East since the start of the season?
I would say that we still don't have any sort of meaningful sample size. So I'll start the answer with that. I do think the Yankees are going to be good. They're just not going to, they're going to rampage at some point. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to correct. It's not going to be like this for them the whole year. The Red Sox, I thought were going to be a good better than a lot of people expected. And I think they're showing that. I don't know that they're going to be the class of the division, but I can see them being a 500 team, maybe a bit above a 500 team and being just enough of a pain in the butt to everybody else in the division. Everything else I think is sort of going to plan, you know, the way to expect it. You know, I think the Blue Jays will correct a little bit. You know, the fact that they've gone through all the injuries that they've had and have the record that they do is a pretty good sign of the depth that they have. But they need George Springer and Teoscar Hernandez back to and Nate Pearson to really start taking off. And, you know, I think we'll start to see that happen in the next little while.
So Drew out of Newfoundland in our Discord asks, and this follows up perfectly here, how much better does George Springer make this lineup? Why and how?
Okay, so, you know, if you're just looking at from a sheer production perspective, you're like, you know, he projects to be roughly 5-win player. So, you know, he's over the course of a season, he's adding 5 wins to your team. You know, that's a pretty sizable impact. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you look at the dynamic presence that he can be at the top of the lineup. You know, if he's being a catalyst on offense, you know, that should set the stage for all the guys behind him a little bit better. Defensively, he gives you Randall Grichuk's been great in center field. So, you know, how much better are they going to be defensively? I'm not sure. But, you know, with him in center, Grichuk in right, Luis Gurriel Jr., Teoscar Hernandez in left, you know, it's a pretty solid defensive outfield that should take away some hits. So I think there's a substantial improvement there. But he, you know, he may need some time to get his timing before he starts producing the way he can. So, you know, we may not see it happen right away. But, you know, I mean, the Blue Jays gave him a lot of money to deliver high impact. And, you know, that's what I think everybody should be expecting.
Awesome. All right. So this next question is kind of goofy, but I laughed, so I threw it in. Jenna out of Edmonton. Yeah, Jenna out of Edmonton says, "Hey, Shai, excited you're on the show. So everyone on Blue Jays Twitter is all over this, but everyone covering the Jays hasn't mentioned it. But you all know Robbie Ray's pants are super tight, right? Like everybody at Sportsnet is seeing this too?"
I haven't really checked it, to be honest. I'm generally not... I don't focus in on kind of guys' fashion decisions.
Of pants? Yeah.
Right. It's not. I'm glad that Blue Jays Twitter is having some fun with that. And, you know, yeah. I've seen it come across my feed a couple times, but it's certainly, look, you know, whatever guys feel comfortable, you know, I always notice when it's freezing cold outside and guys go in bare arms without any sort of long sleeves on, like those, that always strikes me, because I'm like, yeah, you're hardcore to do stuff like that. So that's the kind of stuff that I'll notice.
I was thinking same thing. I was watching when Josh Palacios was up and he doesn't wear his batting gloves and it's Boston
in the cold in Kansas City.
And you're like, oh man, like
right, because you take one off the end of the bat, you're feeling that for five innings.
Yeah. All right. Last question here is from Catherine in Regina, so from Saskatchewan. She says, "Hey, Shai, I've been obsessed with Shohei Ohtani. Could he actually keep this up all year, competing for the home run title and dominating on the mound?"
I mean, we've never seen it before, right? But nobody's been Shohei Ohtani before either. So, like, you're right to be obsessed with him. I think we all are. He is a marvel. The fact that he could throw a 100-mile-an-hour pitch in one inning and then hit a 100-plus-mile-an-hour homer off the bat in another, I mean, it's freakish, right?
Yeah.
Like, this type of talent, I guess Babe Ruth would be the last time we've seen this type of a two-way ability. So can he sustain it? Look, he's had trouble staying on the field in both capacities so far, which has been a real shame.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think part of the calculations the Angels made this offseason was their belief that Ohtani could be a successful two-way player for them. They felt that getting him back after the surgery, that they were sort of adding an ace caliber type of pitcher, and he may turn into that. So I don't know whether or not he's going to sustain it, but I think we're all going to be excited to watch, because you know, there's really been nothing like this. There's just no comp, and that's really cool, especially in a game as long and as storied as baseball.
Shai, thank you so, so much for your time. We really appreciate it, honestly.
Thank you.
Oh, it was a pleasure. It was a fun conversation, guys, and great to take some questions from fans. And, you know, it's going to be a fun season. So I think everybody's going to buckle up and have a little patience, too. It's there's a long, long, long way to go.
141 games to go. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to The Walk-Off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack. Join us for a new episode next Monday.
Oh! Cheese and crackers. Show.